Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome you back. So we start the last series of two talks, and the first one is Patrick Lemaire, who comes from the CRBM in Montpellier. And Patrick will tell us about harnessing inter-individual morphological and molecular variations to unravel Ascidian developmental logics.
Thank you, Denis. Thank you for the kind invitation. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for being here. So I'm going to tell you about not vertebrates. I mean, actually, starting with vertebrates, for those of you who might like these ones in particular. So as you know, twins, true twins, are very similar. They have the same DNA, and you could consider that they are quasi-identical. But if you look at their fingerprints, actually they're not identical. You can see that they are similar, but they're not identical. So you have shared global patterns, but you have significant variation despite identical genomic DNA. And with this, I'd like to say that development is not fully deterministic. There is no one-to-one correspondence between DNA sequence and phenotype. And one of the things we would really like to know is, how do you go from the DNA to phenotypes? What do you need in addition to the DNA to understand what's happening? And if you look at how fingerprints are created, actually we know quite a bit about this. And the fingerprints, what determines the fingerprints are what are called the voral pads, which form at the end of embryogenesis a sort of pads close to the fingers. And depending on the shape of these pads, which in part are due to how they touch the surrounding tissues, you will actually get different classes of fingerprint. So basically what this and many, many other works suggest is that, and this is going back to Waddington, is that genetics define a broad landscape of what the organism can reach. So if you want, this is this landscape. The landscape where, if you consider that development, an embryo is the ball that's going to roll, you know more or less where it could end, but not exactly how it is going to end there. And this landscape is actually determined, again, this is Waddington, this is just an analogy, don't take it for more than what it is. What Waddington suggested is that these pods and ropes are the genes. And so when you change the genes, you're slightly changing the landscape and therefore the trajectories that the embryos may take. So if you want to have a global idea of what's happening, genetics is very important. If you want to understand individual trajectories, you probably need a bit more than that. Now, when I was telling you animal development is reproducible with variations, at what scale are the variations? Are the variations at the scale of the tissue, of individual cells, and is there a pattern? And there are some organisms in which this might be easier to study than in humans or mammals, and one of them is the nematode, Cenorhabditis elegans, where, as you might know from the work of John Selston, you have very precise cell lineages, so each cell has a name, and you can actually know what the cell are going to become. In some cases, the X's mean that the cell is determined to die and not to form part of the adult. So I'm not going to tell you about nematodes, but I'm going to tell you about ascidians. So ascidians are marine organisms, and they are, some of them are very small, some of them are about the size of a fist, just to give you an idea. We're mostly working with this one, Fulugia mammillata. And these are two embryos, which we fertilize in vitro, and we let to develop. And this is very low mag sort of view. The two embryos, they've not been fertilized at the same time, so this one is slightly ahead of this one. But what you could see, it went very fast, is that their development seems very similar. And second, that they form tiny tadpoles. The reason why they form tiny tadpoles is that they belong to the sister group of vertebrates. So these sort of weird things that look like a plant are actually our brothers, more or less, or cousins. So what is, if I take now individual snapshots from the movie, these are the two embryos. And what I did was to show that there is a bilateral plane of symmetry. And I identified with a color the homologous cells between the embryos, because you can find the exact same cell, more or less in the same position, between different embryos of the species, something that is not possible in most systems. And this is the case because we actually, like in C. elegans, have a fixed cell lineage that has been worked out more than a century ago for the early development, and a bit later by Hiroki Nishida in two different species. And in these two different species, more or less, I'm not going to comment, but this cell will divide to form these two cells. And you see each cell has a name, meaning it can be identified as a class across all the embryos. Now, what's spectacular is that this is a deep group. And in this deep group, nearly 400 million years, if you look at the embryos, they're actually nearly identical. So if you look at this cell here, this is this cell here, this is this cell here, 400 million years of divergent evolution. And this is quite unique. If you compare to the nematodes, you have cell lineages that are in most cases also invariant. But each time you have one of these boxes, colored boxes, it means that the cell lineage changes within the group. And if you look at the geometry of the embryos, these are a whole number of species, then you see that the embryonic geometries varies over time within the nematodes. So fine, so this is, ascidians are quite extraordinary for their ability to keep the same pattern, which is probably a very ancestral pattern that dates back from 400 million years ago. Now, how do their genomes look like? And if you look at other sort of living fossils, for example, the gars or the coelacanth that was mentioned earlier today, if you look at the genomes, you find that actually their genomes are extremely slow evolving. This is the number of substitutions per site per million years. And you can see that if you look at the teleosts, these ones evolve very fast. But if you look at the gars, they actually evolve extremely slowly. And it makes sense. The genome evolves very slowly. The morphology evolves very slowly. So how about ascidians? Well, ascidians are the exact opposite. Their genomes, so we have a number of genomes now, a bit less than 240. I mean, more difficult to sequence ascidians than vertebrates. I wonder why. But anyway, we have a number of genomes. And if we look at the evolution of these genomes, the divergence of these genomes, this is incredibly fast. So if you look at coding sequences, the repertoire of genes, the non-coding sequences, the order of the genes on the chromosome, everything is very labile and changes very quickly. So you have this sort of paradox that the phenotype, the end phenotype, is virtually identical besides scaling. But if you look at the genomes, they seem to be living on different planets. And just to illustrate what I was telling about coding genes, this is looking at a tree made with 258 deeply conserved genes. This is a gene tree, I mean, built on these genes. And the longer the branch, the faster the evolution. And you can see these are the vertebrates. All the branches are very short, but the embryos are quite different. Here, the embryos are the same, but you see that the branches to get to the tunicates is very long. But even within the tunicates, all the branches are very long. So what we have somehow is morphogenesis that is extremely conserved, meaning that the phenotypic space that is explored is actually very small. But if you look at, but if you look at the sequence, the part of the genotypic space that is explored to give rise to this is very large. So now what we would like is to try to understand this paradox. And one handle that we have is, well, this morphological phenotypic space, is it actually just a blob or is it actually highly structured? And can we conclude some things from the structure of this phenotypic space? And so what I'm going to tell you a bit about is how can we go from a qualitative description of average development, which has been the sort of traditional approach in developmental biology, to have a quantitative description of variation, and how can this quantitative description of inter-individual variation tell us about the underlying developmental mechanisms? And so how do we first quantify development? Well, first we have to reconstruct the embryos in a way that is more quantitative than just looking at them under a stereoscope. And what we use light sheet imaging. So we started that nearly 15 years ago now. This was the first embryo that we successfully imaged under a light sheet microscope. And this was Ulamai Fusa at the time. And what we do is we label the membranes by injecting RNA that will drive a fluorescent protein to the membrane. And then we image that. And this is just a 3D view of these images. And this embryo also develops nicely, and then it will stop. And it stops actually because after 3 years of work of ULA, the Microsoft updated on this embryo on the microscope. So you can imagine how ULA looked like the next morning when she saw the microscope had stopped. Anyway, the thing is, this data set is about 1 terabyte of data. Very difficult to exploit. So how can we exploit that? So we designed methods so that we could actually segment the embryos one step after the other in a sufficiently accurate way so that we can reconstruct cell lineages. So this is similar to what I showed you for C. elegans, except that C. elegans started with one cell. Here we start with many cells because we start imaging at the 64 cell stage. So each of the 64 cell stage has a tree that comes from it. And you can see here, probably, that there is one thing that is strikingly different from C. elegans. Yes, that's a question.
No cell death.
No cell death, exactly. So this is an animal that makes a tadpole without any cell death. And we can actually image and reconstruct until the embryo has about 1,500 cells and the tadpole has 2,500. So we can image nearly 70% of development now. Now, this is very nice, but what do you do with that? I mean, there isn't much information besides the shape of cells. So what we want is to actually add information, the biological information. And the first one is because there is a cell lineage and invariant development, actually each cell, I told you, has a name. And there are rules, which I won't go into, to specify if you know the mother of the cell, then you know, in theory, the name of the two cells, of the two daughters, and actually depending on their position, relative position, you can assign one of these indices to one daughter and the other one to the other daughter, so that in theory at least, you can have all the same names across all the embryos. And when the embryo that I showed you, actually there are about 50,000 cell snapshots which were named mostly manually at the time. And once you have the names of the cells, you can actually, and this is what Hiroki Nishida did a long time ago, was to micro-inject a tracer in these cells and then to reveal it to know what is the fate map of these different cells. And so you can now actually add that to the description where you have all the cell types from your embryo. And now I'm going to show you the exact same, the same movie as the one I showed you. This is ULA's first embryo, but this is after segmentation and adding the biological information onto these embryos. And this is, I will come back to these things here. This is the neural plate. You see how geometric it is, and you see because they all divide in the same direction, always. They don't respect Hertzsprung's rule. They actually always, divide in the same direction. And now you can also put that back onto the annotated cell lineages. And at the time when we had these things, actually, there was no system that allowed us to explore and interact with these embryos. So what Emmanuel Faure and his colleagues did at the time was to repurpose a video game framework as a serious game, which is, I mean, basically we're using a serious game in order to explore our embryos. And even this is useless, actually. It, usually people like it. It's completely useless for us because there is no cavity in the embryo. So you explore in virtual reality is not very useful. But it works. Anyway, now, so we have a collection of embryos that have been segmented and annotated. And now we can start asking how variable is embryogenesis. And the first thing we can do, the simplest, is you count the number of cells in the embryos. When you do that, you actually find that the number of cells, actually this is quite an old historic picture. Now, all this is the standard deviation. Actually, this has been reduced to zero virtually here because these were residual segmentation errors. What you see is that basically there is utele. All the embryos at the same stage have the same number of cells, nearly exactly. So now, what we would like to do is to use this data set to create a cell resolution atlas. But this means that we need to place all the embryos into a shared reference frame. In theory, this is simple because you should have the same cells, and I showed you that there are the same cells in the embryos. So why do we want to make a cell resolution atlas? There are two things. One, before why, is what are actually the difficulties. So in theory, it's simple. But what we actually want is both to place all embryos in a shared reference frame, but also to keep variation. Because we want to be within this reference frame, we want to be able to study variation. And this is where there is a conundrum here. And so we need the commons reference frame, but inter-individual variation that is kept. And this only works when there is a real invariant that will allow basically to identify homologous cells across the embryos. So the simplest one one can think of is if the embryos have the same cells, they're in the same position, let's register the embryos, look at the barycenters of the cells, compute, align the barycenters of the cells, and that should actually allow us to identify homologous cells. And this is what we did. So first, the embryos do not have the same size. You might have noticed that there is some variation at the size. So put them at the same size, then orient them so that they are oriented in the same way, and then align the barycenters and say, okay, this purple cell here is equivalent to this purple cell here. We can do that, but if we look at the percentage of cells that are properly identified, meaning that they have the same names, the right names, you see that actually in most cases that doesn't work at all. And you also find that the pattern is very unusual. You would expect somehow that you have a monotonous decline. You don't expect to have this sort of troughs and then comes back, and then very deep, and then comes back, etc. This was surprising to us. So we tried. We thought, well, could the conservation of cell numbers actually be misleading? That there may be much more variability than what we thought by just counting the number of cells. And to do that, we started looking at the composition of cells. And for this, we represent one cell by actually whether it is present or not present in an, so we represent one embryo, sorry, by its composition in cells, because we have actually a complete repertoire of cells. So at any given time, we can make a vector that says, yes, the cell is here, no, it is not here. And then we can compute classical distances. Here, this is city block, but you can use Euclidean distance. It's just the same. And what do you expect that we see? So I'm going to give you two alternatives. The first one is basically, this is what we expected, no compensation between lineages. And the other one is basically you have errors that accumulate. So which one do you think we found? Okay, you don't need to just think for yourself. And then again, I expected this one. And we found this one. And this one, if you look at that, you see that up to 30% of cells differ between embryos, but only transiently. So you have fixed cell lineages, but you have up to 30% of cells that differ between embryos. This doesn't sound right. Do you have any idea what these things could be? Cell divisions? Yeah, waves of epidermal cell division. And what is happening in practice is that if you look during a wave here, you're in a wave of cell division, what you find is that all these cells here have the same fate. They're going to be epidermis. But the specific order of division is not the same. So after a few minutes, the whole tissue will have divided. And again, you will have the same cell composition. This is why you come very low, again, in terms of errors. But in the meanwhile, you have big peaks where actually cell composition between two embryos is very different. So now, if you try to use registration of barycenters, you immediately see why it doesn't work, because actually you don't even have the same number of barycenters in the cell. Or you do, actually, you do have the same number, but they're not in the same position spatially. So let's try to find another invariant. And when we started publishing the work on the reconstruction of embryos, what we noticed is that if we look at the neighborhood, the immediate neighbors, the one that contact the cells, this seems to be very well conserved. These are two different embryos. And indeed, if we look at the variation, the percentage of cell contacts that are conserved between the 10 embryos that we sequenced, that we segmented, we find that 90% of the contacts show at least, at most 20% of variation. So it's not just that you have conservation of the cells, you actually have an extraordinary conservation of the contacts that the cell established with their neighbors. And so we think, okay, maybe this is the invariant that we are looking, that we should be looking at. So first what we did was just to compute how many contacts do you have in general. Is the encoding potential of these contacts sufficient? And indeed, you have 5-6 immediate neighbors for each cell. And just after cell division, the contacts are quite different because the shape of the cells during mitosis changes, but very soon it actually stabilizes and you have very little variation over time for a given contact. So a contact is stable over time. And if we now try to see, we're going to, again, we have distances, I won't get into the specific, but this is more or less the percentage of cell surface that is conserved with the neighbors. And you see that in blue, you have the matching cells, so the same cell in two embryos, and you see that in general, you have more than 80% of the surfaces that of contact that are conserved. But if you look at sister cells, and remember the way they are named, the cells, is with respect to their relative position. Now, if we look at the sister cells, we find that the sister cell actually do not have the same cell contacts. Very significantly different. And if you have unrelated cells, so this is actually very, very high. So in most cases, you have no contact. So of course, you have no shared contact. So then we thought, okay, let's try to use this invariant. And now to use, in the same way as when we segmented by progression. Let's do the same thing now, but for the names. So if we have a mother cell that is named FPQ, it will divide into these two cells. So if we know this name, we just have to discriminate between the two daughter cells. And that we can do quite efficiently using the system that I showed you before. So now, can we actually make homologies between cells? And these are two different embryos from Fallujah. And this is one from a different species, which is about 100 million years apart. And you can see that if you look at the color codes match perfectly, despite the geometry and the precise position being actually quite different. So in this case, we can actually make homologous cells, co-homologous cells, but retain the variation. So, what sort of information can we get from there? And the first one that I'm going to tell you about is the orientation of cell divisions, and this is mostly the work of Eddard, who's currently finishing his PhD. So what Eddard did was, now let's, we can register, orient the embryos in the exact same orientation, two embryos. And let's now look at homologous cells and look at the orientation of the cell division. And this orientation is actually, it's not just a line, it's actually a vector, because the two numbers, you see that one is higher than the other, so you can actually orient your the line that links the two cells. And when you do that, you can actually look not only at the mean direction, which is the sort of canonical development, this is the average development, but you can also look at the spread and the distribution. When you do that, what you see is this is just part, this is just for one generation, so generation 7. And here you can see that the colors correspond to different fates, and you see that the patterns seem to be different between the different fates. And we can then focus on the extremes, on the red ones, which are the neural plate, and the blue ones, which are endodermal and some mesodermal, actually, as well. And when we do that, let's first look at the red ones. So I told you that this is the neural plate, and I told you that all the cells always divide in the same direction. And indeed, this is what we find. So if we try to look at the neural plate, and this is the standard deviation in the division orientation angle, you can see that actually this is very low, whereas much, much lower than in the other tissues. And this is true at the seventh generation, this is also true at the eighth generation. So this is what we expected, so it's not very surprising. But if we look now at the other one, this is more surprising because these embryos, they are supposed to be invariant and they are supposed to be very much the same. So how can you have such a large standard deviation in orientation of cell division? And actually, that reflects the fact that really the cells do not divide in the same orientation at all. And this is one example, this is the most striking example, this is A72. And A72, which is an endodermal cell, it will produce two endodermal cells. You can see in this embryo, this is the left hand and this is the right hand. And actually, really, in ascidians, cell divisions can be along completely different axes. Now, you may say, well, actually, why not? These, anyway, make endodermal cells. So you could think that they are interchangeable. So as long as this will form clones that will occupy the same space, it would be fine. So how about cases where the two daughters have different fates? Do we find the same sort of phenomenon, or do you have much more constraints? And the reason why we thought we have much more constraints is that a long time ago, we started reconstructing embryos and measuring the surfaces of contact to the neighbors. This was nearly 15 years ago. And let's look at this cell here. These two cells here, they're actually sisters, but one will form the neural plate and the other one will form epidermis. They're equally competent. The only difference is how much surface of contact they actually establish with the cells that emit the inducer. When you do that, you see that actually A65, so the one that will be neural, has a much larger surface of contact than A66 here that will be epidermal. And so this gives the idea that cell inductions are actually controlled very locally and that surfaces of contact may matter. So now we can look again at the orientation of cell division. So imagine that this cell, the mother, would divide in the other direction. That would create a major issue. So let's try and see now what's happening in terms of variation in cell division orientation between known asymmetric divisions versus mostly symmetric divisions that will adopt the same fate. And you can see that actually the constraints are much higher on the cells that undergo an asymmetric division. So for these ones, it's really important that the orientation of division is something that is invariant. Now, going to go back to this slide. So far, I gave you little snapshots of what you can extract from this type of analysis within one species. But now what happens if you change species? And for this, Fallugia mammillata has completely transparent embryos, but unfortunately, most of the ascidian embryos are not completely transparent. So we cannot reproduce the same experiment exactly with the same microscope on animals that are 200 or 400 million years apart, which we would love, but we cannot. We can do it on fixed, but we cannot do it on live. But we can rely on what our colleagues previously shown. And this is work that was, sorry, it was not done by Christelle at all. It was done by Ian Manetzhagen and his colleague Nicole. And this is in Cyanea intestinalis, and this is the neural plate. And if you see 97, 98, 99, 100, 101, 100, 200, 300, 400, these two are sisters, these two are sisters, these two are sisters, these two are sisters. That's what I was telling you. They always divide in the same direction. But now let's look in Fallugia. This is a bit later than what I showed you up to now. This is the same stage. And you can see that all divide to make a clone that is straight, except these ones. These ones actually divide perpendicular. So this sort of approach actually tells us that what we thought was a very rigid scaffold across species is not. You actually also have variation between these. So now, what I showed you up to now is snapshots, looking at one property. But what we would really like is actually not looking at a property, is to have a global analysis and to be able to actually draw the trajectories that I showed you up to now. And I'm not going to tell you, I mean, we're not there, this is work in progress. What we find is that the fact that there is heterochrony in cell division makes it extremely challenging issue. If you have no cell division, you can just look at the shape of cells. So you can look at the shape of embryo, and that is fine. But if you have cell divisions that do not take place at the same time, then you have, if you do it with your brain, you have to make a call of what is most important. Is it the fact that the shapes are different, or is it the fact that the composition in cells is different? And so the way we're trying to overrule this sort of difficulty is to actually place ourselves in what is called the latent space. So basically to do a massive dimensional reduction, which is actually helped by various neural networks, in order to reconstruct a low-dimensional manifold on which we can actually have the trajectories without having to make a call between cell composition versus cell shape. And I'm not going to show you any data. We're working on that. We have things that look less disappointing than we would have expected, but that's about where we are. And one main thing is, if you want to do that, you cannot do that on 10 embryos. You actually need to have many, many more embryos, and this is currently also a bottleneck. So just to finish, I talked to you about the morphological phenotypic space. I showed you that there is extreme conservation of morphogenesis, but that there is a structure, and at least this structure is in cell division heterochrony and cell division orientation. Now, let's go to genotype space. And for the genotype space, what I showed you before is the idea that you have these genes that actually this landscape, and this is the manifold we're trying to reconstruct more or less. But what is important for the manifold is the activity of the genes. And if you take just this as reality, you think that as soon as the level of expression of one gene changes, your landscape actually changes. So this would suggest that you have a very high level, that transcription gene activity should be very precise in these animals. Is that true? And to do that, what Luisa Falcioni-Stenut started doing is to introduce single molecule FISH based on HCR, and at the same time to label the membranes of the embryo on which she does that, so that she can count the number of transcripts in each cell across many embryos and build sufficient number of statistics. And this is just the one example. This is one example of one experiment. So you can see the membranes and you can see the individual dots, which are actually the individual transcripts. and then you have also the nuclei. And by doing dual labeling the same transcript but with two different probe sets, we established that we detect about 65% of single mRNAs. And this is compatible with what I'm going to tell you now. We can come back to that. And we can segment, and now we have the name of the cells. So we can actually build now for each cell on the right side, on the left side, we can actually say how many transcripts we find. And what you can see is that on average, left and right is more or less the same, but not quite. You can also see that it is very difficult actually to say which cell expresses, which cell does not express. So expression is not binary anymore. It actually becomes a quantitative trait. And in some cases, actually, you can see this in B7-1, left and right are very similar. But in some cases, they're actually very dissimilar. And we know that these embryos, the batch of embryos from which the experiment was done, produces 99% of larvae. So it's not an issue that this embryo would probably have aborted one way or another. So this is just one example on one gene, which was F in this case. But now let's try to do it on many embryos and simplify the system by looking at earlier stages where we just have 24 cells. And the reason why we chose 24 cells is 24 cells is a very transient stage. It lasts for a few minutes. And because we can look at the DNA, we can actually see that these cells, they're actually dividing. And you can see that they're in anaphase or telophase, which is a very, very shorter, even shorter time window than just looking at 24 cell stage. So what I'm going to show you now is not due to the fact that you have slight changes in the stage. The stage is, I mean, not perfectly, but as precisely determined as we can. And now we can actually look at, I'm going to look at two genes, FOXA and FOXD. They're transcription factors, but that doesn't really matter for this purpose. Both of them are targets of the same main regulator, which is beta-catenin. And this is the expression in one embryo of FOXA. You can see again, left, right are pretty similar. These ones are high, these ones are very low. So now, let's look at 9 embryos. And for each cell, you have the number of transcripts that are found. What you can see is that, first of all, if you look at left and right, on average, this is the same. So actually, they are bilaterally symmetrical on average, as you would expect. But now, if you look at the spread, actually, this is very much spread, the expression. This is not precise at all. So, and then we try to see, well, what sort of distribution can we fit onto that? Can we fit a Poisson distribution? Can we fit a negative binomial distribution? Now, I'll tell you after why we chose these two distributions. And this is the Poisson distribution. So here what you have is the mean, and here you have the variance. Poisson means that the mean equals the variance. This is why the line is like that. This is the expression we have. So you see that the variance is much, much higher than what you would expect from Poisson. This is actually, this is much higher. So why did we actually focus on negative binomial? We focused on negative binomial, and I'm going to skip this one, because if you consider that transcription is driven by mass action kinetics, and that you have constant independent events, one transcript is made, and then the next one is made, but there is no memory, then you would actually expect Poisson. So this is not what we find. What does the negative binomial mean? It means that you have correlated events, in other terms, that you have bursty transcription. So that's why, so just by counting very stupidly the number of transcripts that you find in an embryo, in a fixed embryo, then you can actually come back to the idea that you have bursty transcription, which is very nice. But also it tells you the variance equals, for a negative binomial, the mean plus alpha times the mean square, and alpha is the burst size. Actually, 1 over alpha is the burst size, sorry. And this is actually far below what you find in typical mammalians, which are quite precise. It's much more similar to what you find in bacteria. This is very preliminary. We just have 9 embryos. We need to build more. But already it suggests, yes, we've heard the bell. But just to finish, this is the last one. This is the other gene. Same thing, more or less. Spread as well, but does not follow a negative binomial. So not all genes actually follow. It doesn't follow Poisson. It's overspread, but it's not a negative binomial. So that we need to explain and to see, so we can categorize genes according to probably the molecular processes that are underlying. And I'll just stop and highlight the... So most of the work I showed you initially was by Léo and Kilian. Grégoire and is basically the computer scientist behind most of our most sophisticated programs. Emmanuel and Tao are behind Morphonet, and the SM Fish is mostly driven by Louisa. And of course, we have animal husbandry. We do have an animal house. I'm not sure we're fortunate to have an animal house, but we do have one. And thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.